Beth likes to tell the story about the dead man. How she was at her nursing station when something made her go to his room. Not anything she could name. No sound, no buzzer, no signal telling her what to do. It was just some unknown thing that drew her, made her walk down the corridor to his particular door and step inside. She saw the polished floor, window with its view of Minnesota, roads and cars, trees, a few reddish clouds. And then a man lying unnaturally still between two white sheets. She punched the alarm, whipped away the pillows, her fist on his chest like an auctioneer's hammer, a judge's gavel, order, order, one, two, three. Her breath hauled him into his body, his bed, warm cauldron of skin. Yes, she seized his ghost and breathed it back into him. A massive thank you for that introduction, which was a bit scary, and to Paul for inviting me here tonight. It's a real honour to be reading here, and particularly on the crest of the wave of all those wonderful five-word or sword poems, as they should be, you know, from now. So a massive thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm from Somerset in England in the very beginning, and my mum grew up in a very small village. And I've done a lot of travelling all my life, but my whole family have stayed in one place. I've got a huge family, and they're all around Bridgewater and this very tiny village. Anyway, where my mum grew up, there was quite a big gypsy encampment nearby, and I'm convinced that my real father was actually one of the gypsies, and I've tried to get my mum to tell me the truth, and she's resisted so far. But this is the true story of my beginning. The gypsy was drawn across the levels by the scent of my mother, sleek in chiffon dress, walking through the farmyard. It was a still day, cows steady as stone, mice nested in hay. No shadow, no wind, the fleet-footed Romany racing through fields of wheat. She felt him coming, her cheeks flushed, hands unsteady, feet standing on an edge that didn't exist. Consummation was written way before the act. The thick spring air heaved with it, new leaves whispered and gossiped. She'd been counting the signs, dropped knives foretelling a stranger's arrival, a V of geese in flight. The gypsy too was like one possessed, his running heart, a blaze of unscored love drawn from the strings of his fiddle, night after night. My mother swears the ground trembled as he ran across those fields, swears she was shaking in his arms as a single heron took flight and the first beat of me was set alight. That's the truth. So I've done a lot of work, or I do a lot of work, with migrating stones, with ways in which stones move around. And it began quite involuntarily, actually. I had a dream shortly after my grandmother died, and she was quite a strong woman, and she told me to go and climb a mountain in North Wales called Cadair Idris. So I'm going to read a few poems relating to the stone project. And this is the first one about going to the mountain and being in the foothills. And I've stolen the last line, unashamedly, from Robert Burns. So many thanks to him for the ending. So it's called Foothills Girl. I'm a dedicated foothills girl, dreaming where the stream runs fast and trees screech towards the sky. at home in the crook of an oak, watching moss skin stones while the mountain climbs behind me. No one else stops here but me, seduced by low-life greening and the perfume of pine. Nothing here is mine, and I'm madly in love, thinking of proposing marriage to a mountain, if you're allowed to do such a thing. Love, honour, and obey. I'd stay faithful to this rock more easily than any human. We'd live out our mutual passion day by voluptuous day until the floods came, or we both melted with the sun. I quite like the idea of proposing marriage to a mountain. Somebody said to me, how do you know if a mountain agreed or not? You have a great performance going up the mountain in a fabulous dress and having a big party. Anyway, halfway up the mountain, I encountered this very large boulder that looked as if it had nothing to do with anything else around it. And a man came along who happened to be a geologist, and he told me that it was an erratic, which some of you know what that means. For those of you who don't, it's a stone that breaks away from the mother bed and lodged in a glacier. And then got carried away across the country when the glacier was making canyons and gorges, and then it gets dropped when the glacier melts. So you end up with stones in certain places, and the stone has no relation to the stone that's around it. So in Cornwall, there's one beach where there's a piece of red gneiss, G-N-E-I-S-S, that's come from Greenland in ice. So I became rather obsessed with this and the way in which stones move. And I started thinking of them as the original travellers, really. And this was one of the first poems that I wrote for the project. And all the I've taken four stones around the world with the first line of this carved into them. And stones move silently across the world, hurled into an empty ship's weightless hold, folded into a glacier's freezing fist, quick-pocketed by tourists and children, with an eye for things shiny and round. Bound for other lands, stones sailed without papers, traffickers in freedom, crossing borders with no regard for guards, guard dogs or guns. Dumb as the tongueless, their acts alone sounded the long, low cry. Each stone carried centuries of weight and meaning. Ballast from Bristol, belly up in New York's East River. Erratics paused on the slopes of Kader Idris. Fingers of quartz startling my windowsill. All of them travelled from the place where they began, where we might have said they belonged. Migrating past line, border, boundary. Their movements a constellation of questions. Where is home? What is home? And who in this world can claim land as their own? A different way of moving stones here. This is called swallowing stones. Some animals swallow stones for digestion. This one swallowed it to help it swim. Some scientists suggest that plesiosaurs swallowed stones for ballast, to keep them from rising to the surface when they were engaged in underwater flying, thus enabling them to travel more efficiently in a horizontal direction, and obliterating the infernal tendency of air to make all things rise. And I wonder if the same might be true of my inability to forget you, small stones swallowed to count of memory's lack of gravity, leaving me image-free and finally able to journey without you. And then my last stone one for you. I guess the point when I think these stones actually want to move, I'm sure if any of you have driven here tonight, if you look in the kind of footwell of the car, you'll see a whole little tribe of stones sitting there, moving around with you until you expel them at some point. This is called stowaway. There's a stone hitching a ride in my shoe, nagging my heel with its intransigent edges, dimpling hardened skin to make a space for itself. Stone no bigger than a sequin, day tripping from one street to the next. So I'll just read a few from my latest, but I thought we'd go somewhere really hot next. I'm lucky enough to have a friend who lives in Mexico, in Guadalajara, and I go out and visit her occasionally. So this is called Teotitlan. Companions, I do not know if we chose that day, or if the day chose us, to ride a bus out of Guadalajara to Teotitlan. We slugged our way up the burning hill, butterflies bigger than hands, a single iguana lodged in a hedge, black-eyed and motionless. Everything pulsed with heat. Stones, grass, road, the circular pyramids, and the mythical avenue through them. We ate lunch on a stony peak, stared into distances that seemed to draw nearer the quieter we became. Clouds bannered the horizon's rhythmic line, and time made no conversation. Later, we walked along a track crowded with black, fuchsia-tailed butterflies, shade that fell like snow from trees and swam in a cool freshwater pool where fish nibbled our toes and a young boy squealed. Companions, I do not know if we chose that day or if the day chose us. 7, 8 wild mustangs came crashing down the hill and into the water, cooling their burning hides, their flaming manes. It's another distant one, this next poem. Something that interests me when I travel around is how I navigate. I'm sure we've all had guidebooks that tell you the things you must go and see and you must do. And I always feel quite burdened and overwhelmed by this kind of list of things. And I'm always happiest when I stumble from one back street to another, really, kind of finding little things on the way. So this is called Finding Something Important in Istanbul. It wasn't the magnificent Galata Bridge and the hundreds of men fishing in the middle of the day in the middle of the city. It wasn't the Topkapi Palace or the great round trays of honeyed and pistachio baklava. It wasn't the rooftop table where we ate breakfast or the flotilla of ships on the sun-kissed Bosphorus. Not even the Blue Mosque or the Hagia Sophia or the cafe in the graveyard and that sweet apple tea. It was the nameless place where we waited for a ferry to Fener. An old man offered us two rickety seats under a blue plastic sheet. and an older man made us two cups of instant coffee. A skinny cat and bob of boats, grubby table and diesel fumes. Not the sights you must see, but the oversights, the ones you're told to avoid. Something beautiful exploded between one thing and another. The plastic sheet and the sky, the rubbish in the water, and the smile on the old man's face. So I'm from a town that's called Street. People often used to say, where do you come from? And they'd say Street, and they'd say, yes, but where do you come from? Street. It's a town in Somerset. It's the home of Clark Shoes. The clubs were made by, and they were set up by Quakers, who were great philanthropists, so the whole town centred around it. My dad worked in the factory there all his life. And it's just a couple of things here. We used to have a Henry Moore sculpture outside the factory. And also, if you were lucky enough to be a daughter of an employee of the factory, you could have this thing called wear test shoes. So whenever they had a new design, I'd go in and they'd measure my feet and I'd get a brand new pair of kind of these uniquely designed shoes, but only for 6 weeks. And then I'd have to hand them back so they could see, you know, if they'd worn well or not. Anyway, the factory, like most factories, isn't there anymore. So this is just an unashamed piece of nostalgia, really. Clark Shoe Factory Street. What I wanted was the factory before it turned into a shopping village. Wanted the Henry Moore sculpture back on the grass by the factory tower. Wanted the hum of sewing machines and that dusty smell of leather. Wanted to cycle past the stinking tannery, to walk in wear test shoes, to eat the cakes at Clark's Christmas party. Not nostalgia, but a wanting for things that made us. The workers' dirty hands, the day after day, the donuts in the canteen. My father going up and down Street High Street for more than 40 years. The fact that things were being made, the attraction of that, the grit and the skill and the boredom. I wanted to see it all again, to know the cut of cowhide, the stitch, the moulded sole of a shoe. Not the museum, but the living practice. And the meaning of that brick, high up in the factory wall, with the words, more light, carved into it. So I've just got a couple more. I thought no reading would be complete without a love poem. And it'll be clear why I've written this after the last poem. This is love poem for a shoe. You steady the swirling earth. Lay yourself down over puddles. Shelter me in storms. You mold to my shape. Caress my skin with your skin. Hold me when I topple and bones threaten to break. Last with me. Your tongue is sweeter than Shakespeare's when my foot is in your mouth. Four-chambered, doe-eyed, cow sacrifice stitched, uppered and arched into two little boats for my feet. Together we meet the years, the blisters, the 10,000 miles of road. I hope nobody can identify with this. It's kind of about first love and how it It never seems to go away. Dear dream doctor, night after night, I still dream of him. As if all the years of separation, how many is it now? 20, 22, 23, count for nothing. There have been other lives, other lovers, but still he appears with the same face, the same voice, as if the needle of choicelessness that stitched us together once still stitches us together now. Reliable as the rituals of breakfast, dinner, tea, he comes to me. What keeps him there, in this country that can never be mapped? There was no thought back then of the sentence I might be destined to serve. Love old as stars and just as inextinguishable. Dear dream doctor, what am I failing to see? And do you know if he spends night after night dreaming of me? I'll finish with this one. I lived in a very small village in North Devon for 7 years, and called Heartland. It's a village called Heartland. And there was an abbey there. The original abbey doesn't exist anymore. There's a new building. But there are very old paths and roads where the monks would have walked. And when I was walking, I often had the sense that I wasn't alone. And there's a quote at the beginning of this one from W.G. Sebald. And he said, "The dead and the dying aren't really gone. They just hover somewhere at the perimeter of our lives and keep coming in on brief visits." So this is walking the Abbey Road. To walk where monks once would have walked. To step where they too have stepped. To press these lips to the same sea-salted air. To taste on a breeze lost fevers of their talk. To be with them is everywhere and nowhere, spinnakered against the wind like a blade of grass, like a tree upshooting and rooting, a dot on a curve of a very long line. To be with them is to step out of time, to unsign the treaty that binds us to past, present, future. A dot on a curve of a very long line. That line is circle, beckoned, sublime. You see, I do not believe in the otherness of the dead. In my heart there is a green light shining.